This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout the war, Allied casualties have been reported as extremely low. For the most part, civilians in Allied countries have not been at risk. But civilians in Iraq and Kuwait have endured considerable suffering. When the war in the Gulf ends, thousands of people around the world will be trying to reestablish contact with family members and friends in Kuwait and Iraq. In last month's issue of the British literary magazine Granta, Indian novelist and anthropologist Amitabh Ghosh wrote about an Egyptian friend of his who was working in Baghdad when the war broke out. Ghosh had visited the man's family in September, but they'd already lost contact with him. Ghosh says he was struck that so much of the reporting about the crisis was depersonalized, about oil and arms, not people. He wanted to write about a single person who was trapped in the war. I asked him why his friend went to Baghdad in the first place.
I think he went for much the reason that any other, that most Egyptians go, which is that, you know, he'd finished school, he'd finished going to college, he'd done his military service, and now he was left with a degree. And really, there was no employment for him anywhere in Egypt. So he just needed a job, and he went. And in this period, you know, around about 83, 84, 85, when Iraq began to recruit more and more foreign workers because, all Iraqi manpower was being directed towards the war with Iran, a lot of Egyptians went. And he was just one of a huge wave, people say that there were at some stages there may have been up to 1.5 to 3 million Egyptians in Iraq, and indeed at the moment, despite the huge exodus out of Iraq, people still think that there's probably 750,000 Egyptians or so still living there. So in a sense, he was just impelled by economic necessity. The whole of the whole Egyptian community in Iraq was really impelled by economic necessity in that way.
Now, his cousin also went to Iraq to work, and his cousin returned before the war, but your friend wanted to stay a little longer and make a little bit more money. I want you to read something from the ending of your piece, An Egyptian in Baghdad. And this is the part toward the end where your friend's cousin has returned to the village, and you're talking with him about what life was like in Iraq, and you ask him about Saddam Hussein.
Okay. Saddam Hussein, he rolled his eyes. You have to be careful when you breathe that name out there. There are spies everywhere, at every corner, listening. One word about Saddam and you're gone, dead. In those ways, it's terrible out there, though of course there's the money. But still, you can't live long out there. It's impossible. Did you hear what happened during the World Cup? Earlier in the year, Egypt had played a football match with Algeria to decide which team would play in the World Cup. Egypt had won, and Egyptians everywhere had gone wild with joy. In Iraq, the hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who lived packed together, all of them young, all of them male, with no families, children, wives, nothing to do but stare at their newly bought television sets, they had exploded out of their rooms and into the streets in a delirium of joy. Their football team had restored to them that self-respect that their cassette recorders and television sets had somehow failed to bring. To the Iraqis, who have never seen anything like a normal political life, probably never seen crowds except at pilgrimages, the massed ranks of Egyptians must have seemed like the coming of Armageddon. They responded by attacking them on the streets, often with firearms. Well-trained in war, they fell upon the jubilant, unarmed crowds of Egyptian workers. You can't imagine what it was like, said Ismail. He had tears in his eyes. It was then that I decided to leave. Nabil decided to leave as well, but of course he always needed to think a long time about everything. At the last minute, he thought he'd stay just a little bit longer. A little later, we went to his house to watch the news on the color television he had brought back with him from Iraq. It sat perched on its packing case in the center of the room, gleaming new, with chickens roosting on a nest of straw beside it. Soon the news started and we saw footage from Jordan. Thousands and thousands of men, some in trousers, some in galabeahs, some carrying the television sets on their backs, some crying out for a drink of water, stretching all the way from the horizon to the Red Sea, standing on the beach as though waiting for the water to part. There were more than a dozen of us in the room now. We were crowded around the television set, watching carefully, minutely, looking at every face we could see. But there was nothing to be seen except crowds. Nabil had vanished into the pages of the epic Exodus.
I think it really does change the way you see the refugees coming out of a city or the people being bombed in a city when you know somebody there, someone who you're worried about, who you care about. I guess that's what you're doing with this piece.
Yes, that was really my intention. You know, it's a very curious thing for people who know the Arab world, you know, or you know, Arab culture to some degree, that, you know, there's an enormous kind of Arabic literature, you know, and say, you know, there were really good Arabic novels written in the 1920s and 1930s and so on. But somehow these novels have not found their way into world literature, you know. I mean, I think India has been much more successful in portraying its literature abroad. And this is, you know, in a sense, when you look at the way that this war came about, to my mind, it seems that there's really profoundly a failure of culture there, you know. A failure of culture on the Arab side, in that the Arab side has really not been able to communicate with the world outside in the ways that I think most Arabic-speaking people would want. But equally in that, say, people like me or people who know the Arab world have really been completely incapable of providing, you know, the people who live there a face, an image of ordinariness, you know, which is, after all, what the Arab world is composed of, just ordinary people, you know, like you or me or everyone else. I mean, different in their own ways, of course, but people with very ordinary ideals, very ordinary ways of carrying on their lives. So, you know, I remember when I left Egypt in September, I mean, I was already writing this article then, suddenly it struck me that, you know, when I read these newspaper reports, when I read this sort of really completely dehumanized language that was applied to the Middle East, it really struck me that, in some sense, what we were encountering there, what I was seeing there, was profoundly a failure of culture.
Have you heard from your friend? Do you know if he's gotten out of Iraq?
I have no means of knowing. No, he still hadn't in September, so I have an uneasy feeling that he hasn't. I think he's probably still in Baghdad.
Is it kind of typical for people in one Arab country to travel to another country to get work? Do people, you know, migrate a lot between countries in the Arab world?
Yes, there's been enormous migration since about the 70s. But, you know, there's an odd kind of sort of dialectic there, really. Because, you see, the Gulf states, traditionally Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates and so on, in many ways, you know, although their stated policy is what they call, you know, hiring more and more Arab workers, in fact, they've tried, or at least they've left it open for private entrepreneurs in their country to hire more and more workers from other Asian countries. So, in fact, one of the largest suppliers of labor to the Middle East, to these Gulf countries, is in fact India. I think Pakistan comes a close second. But there's a real reason for this, you see, because when you in a country like that, when you get large groups of, say, Egyptians or, you know, Syrians or Moroccans or whatever, in a way, they have a greater stake in the country. They have a greater kind of political impact upon that country, and of course, they often also want to stay longer. You know, they want political rights. They want you know, those human rights which you know, any migrant expects when he goes to other countries. Whereas when they get people from, say, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, who go there on very short contracts and are sent back pretty soon, that whole range of issues is completely shut out. And I think that's one of the real problems that lies behind the current crisis.
You were saying that it's really a shame that people in the West don't know Arab literature, and
yes,
that it would really help us understand Arab culture, and that, you know, we're missing out on something.
Yes.
And you said that you thought it was a failure of the Arabs, that we didn't know that. In what respect do you think it's an Arab failure that the literature isn't known in the West?
Well, I think, say, one of the failures is really that, you know, so much money in the Arab world is spent on, say, on armaments, on, you know, on all kinds of things like that, on cars, on consumer goods, and so little is really spent on, you know, on film, on good films, on good books, on, you know, publishing good books, making them widely available. And, you know, it's really a crying shame because, in fact, you know, one of the oddest things about the Arab world is that I think in the West, people think of, say, you know, Arabic literature or Arabic culture as being something which is sort of somehow, you know, very old-fashioned or something like that. And, in fact, you know, The Arab world has had the first modernist movements of any country in the Third World. I mean, they were writing the most incredibly, controversial, radical, really exciting books, in the 20s and the 30s. And none of that ever seems to sort of get out into the world outside. And one of the reasons for that is, of course, again, that the money in the Arab world on the whole is controlled by very conservative, very traditional people who are not really willing to spend any money at all on cultural things, on cultural things of any value. I have some friends in Egypt, for example, who are extremely talented filmmakers. It's almost impossible for them to get funding for their own films. Let me just give you one example. I think one of the finest films last year was a film made by this Egyptian director, a very famous Egyptian director called Yusuf Shaheen. It was called Alexandria Again and Again. And really, it's an astonishing film. It's a film which really takes on the whole question of, personality cults in politics in the Arab world. It deals with it really frontally. Now, this film was just completely neglected. I don't think it's even been released in America. It's been released in Europe, but I don't think it's even found a release in America. And it's really an astonishing film. Now, I'm sure if Yusuf Shaheen were to make a film which had lots of camels in it and, a sort of Bedouin and so on, it would find instant release all around the world. So the Western world has really chosen to reinforce its stereotypes about the Middle East.
Amitav Ghosh is the author of the novels The Circle of Reason and The Shadow Lines. He spoke to us from Station WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Coming up, a talk with Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. This is Fresh Air. Last night, Baghdad Radio announced that Saddam Hussein had ordered the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, and he was calling on the UN to declare a ceasefire. This morning, President Bush called the statement just more hype and said that Saddam must personally and publicly accept all UN resolutions calling for an unconditional withdrawal from Kuwait. So the fighting has continued. At a briefing this afternoon, the Pentagon announced that it does appear that the Iraqi forces in Kuwait are in full retreat. And some experts are projecting that the end of the war may be near. We called Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. Saddam Hussein wanted his troops to be able to retreat with their weapons. President Bush said soldiers retreating with weapons would be treated like combat units. I asked Admiral Carroll if it was reasonable to expect that we'd let them retreat with weapons.
In the present circumstances, it is improbable that any adversary would permit the enemy to withdraw from the battlefield with all of their weapons intact. This has been a terrible confrontation, and it came to this violent level. Having gone that far, then it's understandable that one party wants the other one to lay down their arms and leave the battlefield after they've been defeated.
When a war ends, does a country ever retreat with its weapons?
Oh, there have been many, many, many wars settled over the course of history in which scarcely any damage was done on either side, and the one who considered themselves a loser was permitted to withdraw with full dignity and in good form and with weapons. The idea of the unconditional surrender, in which one party simply abandons all identity and all control and surrenders to the other party, is a rather new idea in warfare. Almost of this generation, of this century, and believe me, there are certain very serious shortcomings with the idea of unconditional surrender.
What would the disadvantages to the victor be?
It is generally accepted that one of the few mistakes that President Franklin D. Roosevelt made in World War II was to insist upon unconditional surrender of the Axis powers. In the first place, it sustained the war. We had to keep fighting, and we lost a lot more lives than were necessary. In the second place, it gave the Soviet Union much more time to advance from the east and to take over a good part of Europe that they might not have been in had we negotiated a settlement months before the final surrender. You cost lives, you spend treasure, and you produce political circumstances by a demand for unconditional surrender that can often be avoided by a well negotiated settlement of the war on less than unconditional surrender terms.
The United States is asking the Iraqis to lay down their arms and retreat, and the United States says that the coalition forces will not fire on Iraqis who have laid down their arms. On the other hand, there is no ceasefire. Is it reasonable to expect soldiers to lay down their arms when there isn't a ceasefire? I know that adversarial soldiers watching the soldiers lay down their arms wouldn't shoot at them. On the other hand, this is a war in which there's missiles getting fired from quite a distance, and the people firing those missiles might not know that there were unarmed soldiers about to get hit by them.
Well, this is right at the crux of the problem. If we are so insistent upon this action by Saddam Hussein personally to signal an end of the war before we will stop firing upon Iraqi forces, then the forces in the field, which might be very well inclined to cease hostilities and to get out, aren't going to take that action. If you expose yourself on a battlefield, particularly to aircraft, which are just looking for motion, looking for forces that are exposed to air attack, you put your life in immediate jeopardy. What is needed is a brief period for the signal to go that we're not attacking any longer, you are free to withdraw. Anytime we saw any effort to use such a hiatus to reinforce, resupply, repair, strengthen Iraqi military forces, we would not be obligated in any respect to respect that action. That could be attacked directly and repeatedly. The fact is, the administration is so determined that this will be an abject and humiliating surrender by Saddam Hussein that it is interfering with efforts to resolve the situation on the battlefield and to make it possible for the Iraqi troops to withdraw in safety.
The United States now has troops in southern Iraq, and there, too, I think the conditions are the same, that the coalition forces wouldn't fire on retreating soldiers without their weapons, but would fire on retreating soldiers with their weapons. Now, we're not talking about a country that Iraq has invaded any longer. We're talking about Iraq itself. Is there any reason why the conditions should be different in Iraq for how the military and its weapons are treated?
Once again, we're in the fog of war, the fog of the battlefield, and no force well inserted in Iraq is for a moment going to tolerate anything that looks ambiguous or threatening. Therefore, how the ceasefire, if it comes, is to be implemented with respect to coalition forces well in Iraq. It isn't just southern Iraq, it's almost to central Iraq now. I don't know. Signals are going to have to be unambiguous and the actions clear so that we can disengage, get our forces out with complete safety and assurance that Iraq is not using the opportunity to reconstitute its forces and attack our retirement.
Do you think the coalition forces have virtually already won militarily?
Yes, the air war undoubtedly sapped both the Iraqi ability to defend and their will to defend. Their will and leadership is totally lacking. The overwhelming force directed against them has turned into just a walkover in military terms. It's a question now of being less arbitrary and less pedantic about the meaning of words and getting on to the outcome that we want, which is an end to shooting and killing and the complete withdrawal of all Iraqi forces from Kuwait.
But don't you think that the coalition forces want more than that, that they want probably an end to Saddam Hussein and an end to Iraq's military power?
This is yet to be determined. Clearly, an end to Saddam Hussein is far beyond the UN resolutions. This is where we get into very difficult situations. Iraq could comply with the most important UN resolutions, 660 and 678, and Saddam Hussein still remained fully and firmly in power in Baghdad. If we say that part of the outcome has to be his dismissal or his elimination, then we're changing the objectives, and we're also probably changing the military requirements. It might even be necessary to go all the way to Baghdad with military force to be certain that Saddam Hussein is removed.
If there are no big surprises left, and the war ends soon, and the coalition forces have achieved a very clear-cut military victory and a very swift victory in the ground war, do you think that we'll be left with, a kind of unrealistic image of war, where you go in, you do the job very quickly, very few people get hurt from your side?
Yeah, absolutely. This war is going to exorcise the ghosts of Vietnam. We lived for a long time with the image of a feudal war being fought on and on and on for no political or military purpose. This very rapid, violent war is going to communicate to the American people, oh, yes, we can use military power successfully and for benefit. And this war in the Gulf is going to be cited as the justification for a strategy which maintains American service personnel all over the world ready to go to war in any local situation where we think our interests are threatened. And believe me, if we mindlessly buy into this strategy that the U.S. is the world's policeman and Iraq proves we can do it, we're going to be tying yellow ribbons around trees for years and decades to come.
Eugene Carroll, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for calling.
Retired Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.